welcome to Beyond the Ball with me, Collie. This week, we have a special show. This week, I have Connor with me.
Hey, thanks.
And I've got Paddy.
And that's why it's special.
Ladies and gents, we have a bit of a high-profile guest, I suppose you'd call him, wouldn't you? So we have a League of Ireland legend, a St. Patrick's Hall of Famer, the only player ever to win the PFAI, the SWAI, and the FAI Player of the Year in the same year. I don't know if he's knew that one. That's. The man has also done unbelievable things, won six leagues with five of Pats, one with Shamrock Rovers. He's won two League of Ireland Cups, and he's the current manager of the under-16 Irish team. Ladies and gents, we have Mr. Paul, how's things?
Good, thanks very much. Nice introduction.
To live up to now. I didn't realize that list was so long there. Though. Yeah. I'm trying to glance down. It's a lot to remember. Like, you've done a lot in your career. So
that's the error.
I didn't realize half of that. So thanks for reminding me. Good memories.
Yeah, it's good to
grant your agent memory. Now and look for more money for this.
Yeah, just let me know if you need any more promo work done or anything like that. You know? Right, look, Paul, we'll jump straight into it. First thing I want to talk to you about is just kind of, obviously you had a great career at Pats, but before you kind of, I suppose, hit the big time, obviously we know Pats signed you from Mount Merion, but what was your schoolboy career like? Were you always at Mount Merion, or were you kind of, was there any other teams that you were at? It's hard to kind of find that before Mount Merion. So
yeah,
talk to us about kind of your schoolboy journey.
Yeah, okay. Mount Merion would have been the last club, obviously, before I signed for Pats, but I only had a short spell in Mount Merion. I had my main club was Leicester Celtic as a schoolboy. They played up in, I think it was Marley Park at the time. So I would have played there. Sorry, I would have played there and also for Nuckgrove Celtic, because I lived up in that area. So Nuckgrove Celtic, Leicester Celtic, schoolboy clubs. I had a little spell with Stella Maris.
Okay, yeah.
Out in the north side was a camel ride to get out there back in them days. Lucky enough, there was one bus went from Nuckgrove to Drumcondra, the 16A bus, so I could get that out. But I went out one time for a game, and it was snowing, and the communication wasn't like what it is now with social media and mobile phones and everything. But they inadvertently forgot to tell me the match was off, so. I was on the check out to Drumcondra to find out the game was off, so needn't tell you I didn't go back out again. So that was my spell with Stella Maris.
You built a snowman anyway, did you?
Well, I then went to I had a little spell. I signed for St. Joseph's, Sally Noggin, and then I had a little bit of a, I don't know what you call it. I wanted to sign for Rangers in Bushy Park because was a lad called Peter Mockler who had been very good to me around the area with Nuckgrove Celtic and that. And he was managing Rangers in Bushy Park, and I wanted to sign for them and leave Joey's. And between one thing and another, the transfer paper wasn't signed, and I felt at the time that Joey's probably didn't do as much as they could have to enable that to happen. So I ended up not playing for about a year after that because I couldn't play for Rangers, and I didn't want to play for Joey, so I ended up out of the game a bit for a while, probably at around the critical age, around 15, 16. So I kind of stopped playing a bit then, and I was going to Ballantyre Community School, and I don't know if you're familiar with the comedian Sean Connors. Tom Reeves is his real name, his stage name is Sean Connors. But his son was in school with me in Ballantyre. Now, I played for the school team in Ballantyre in the community. Yeah. And we quite a good side, some good players. But Sean was managing Bradford Rovers on their 17s or 18s at the time. And his son, Joe, asked me would I go and play, and I didn't really want to play. I kind of lost the love of the game as such.
Yeah.
And it was at, I suppose it was at an age where there were other things. Probably more focal to you.
Yeah.
And football. So I said, look, I don't really want to do it. So he said, well, my dad wants to come down and speak to you. So I'd never met Sean before. So he came down to the house, and mum and dad's house there in in All Holy Lands, as it was called at the time. And he was a comedian by trade, and he was a very, very funny man, still is.
Yeah.
Into the house, and he just lit up the house, and he kind of convinced me to sign for Bradford Rovers. So can't tell you what year that was, but it's probably the mid-80s. Said mid-80s.
Yeah.
Played for Bradford Rovers, and a couple of good seasons there. We won a lot of trophies there in the amateur league, underage. Yeah. Might have been under 18 amateur league. We had a really good side and a couple of really good seasons there. And then I moved from there to, I think I played a half a season with Arbor. Arbor United, who would have been a senior team.
Yeah.
Down around Clonskee, kind of Windy Arbor there. Windy Arbor, just down the road from Dundrum. And my two brothers played there as well. So I played a season or a half season with them. And I'd finished school then at that time, and I'd done my leaving cert, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I got a job. The Nutgrove Shopping Centre was only newly built.
Oh yeah,
I got a job in there on the fish counter, believe it. I was working.
That's why no one would mark you, was it?
I was wondering why none of the women would talk to me when I was in the nightclub. So anyway, I was working there for a while, and then I moved out onto the shop floor, and I kind of got pally with a lad who was working for one of the. He was a merchandiser there working for Big Grazers, one of those companies.
Right.
And he was involved in Mount Merion. But just before that, actually, we had the Quinsworth Cup, it was called. So it was all different stars around Dublin played in a knockout competition. And we played, and I think I'm not sure if we won it. I know we got to the final anyway. And this lad from Mount Merion used to come and watch. So he asked me would I be interested in going to Mount Merion. And at this stage, I actually wasn't playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I'm not really that interested in going. So I kept at me anyway. So I went up just to have a look at that, and it suited me. It was the amateur league. I think it was the top league in the amateur league at the time. But the standard was decent, but there was no pressure to train and things like that, and fairly casual. So I went there, and I played there. Really enjoyed it. And then there was a night we were playing against it. I'm nearly sure it was a thing called St. Brendan's. They were from over the north side, and Billy Baxter, who was assistant manager with Pats at the time, he came to watch two of the players playing for St. Brendan's.
Yeah.
I think they were going for the league, and we were kind of mid-table. But in back in them days, the manager of Mount Merion would I'd play anywhere on the pitch. Like, I'd play up front, yeah. Play in the field, play at the back. And it would depend on how... It's terrible when I think about it, but it depends on how I felt, you know. And that's not sad. I might have been working that day and might have been a bit tired and mightn't have fancied a shift in midfield, you know. So I know it was a midweek game, and when we went up, I said to him, listen, can I play at the back tonight? I don't feel very energetic, so not saying it's easy.
It'd be nice to have that build, you'd be able to do that.
I'm gonna get away with that after that. I played at the back, centre back, and the two lads that Billy came to watch were playing us. I think in them days it was 4-4-2, the two centre forwards. And I remember we won the game, and I remember I had quite a good game. I think I scored a couple of goals from free kicks, like direct free kicks, and had a good game and kind of stifled the two lads that he came to watch. So we went for a beer then in the local pub after the game, and I think the manager came to me and said, there's a fella here who wants to talk to you. So that was my first time I met Billy Baxter, and he was a big influence on my career after that. But he said to me, would it be interesting going down to Pats? And I said, no, I just like playing locally with the pals and that. I said, I'm not that serious about it. So between one thing and another, you got Brian Kerr rang me, and Robbie Gaffney, who was a local fellow up around Ballantyre at the time. Robbie was a really, really good player. He played for Rovers, and he was at Pats at the time. And he contacted me as well and said, would you not come down and give it a go? So I ended up going down to the Pats, I think it was 1988,
yeah,
the pre-season. And from there, I signed. I had a year or so in the reserves. And ironically, the following season, which was 89-90 season, I was sub for the first game down in Limerick.
Yeah.
And Robbie Gaffney, unfortunately, broke his leg very early in the game.
I remember reading that,
And I had to come on for him, so it was kind of a little bit of irony attached to it that happened that way. And I played then, and I think I played a fair bit of that season. the rest then I kind of went on and had a decent career then after that.
So just staying on the schoolboy career just for a sec. So was that kind of your first glimpse of any type of skill coming towards you? Was kind of St. Pat's? There was nothing from abroad or anything like that. It was always kind of the first you've heard of it. Like,
no, I think again, I remember there was one time Everton. There was something with Everton. I really can't remember, but I didn't really pay attention to too much.
Yeah,
you know, but I remember it was the old, I think it used to be the Evening Herald and the Evening Press. And I think there was a headline on the Evening Press on the back page and the sport page that I was bound for Goodison. Right. I think I got injured actually around that time, a cartilage injury in my knee.
Yeah.
But no, when I was playing schoolboy, there was a bit of interest, all right, from cross channel clubs. So nothing ever materialized. And I don't think I played long enough as a schoolboy to really.
Were you as big as you were, kind of, obviously, like, were you that size, kind of, at skillboy level? Because I think that's probably a massive thing, is the size is kind of always, you know, if you're head and shoulders above everyone else, you stand out a little bit more if you have the talent, like.
Would you not use the word tall rather than big? Because you make
well, look, big, you know, strong. I'll use big the word strong. Yeah, yeah, big and strong.
I'm only teasing you. Yeah, I was always tall, so, you know, I probably had advantage. I was quite, I'd say Bambi-ish when I was younger, you know, up until probably early 20s, even when I started playing in the league with Pats. I was kind of too tall for my frame, and legs were kind of a bit Bambi, I used to call it, as they call it, you know. So I was a bit like that when I was younger as well, and probably led to some of the injuries I had as well. Yeah. But I was always quite tall. I wasn't great in the air, you know, for my height.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I'm 6'4", but I can remember fellas, Declan Daly down in Cork City, he's probably 5'10", and he's winning every header, and I'm going, what's going on here? But,
the gaffer give you a stick on that one.
Yeah, who did?
The gaffer would say, giving you a stick on that one. Like.
Yeah. He said, you're the only fella, actually, Ray Tracy, Lord rest him, when I played at Rovers, he said to me, you're the only man I know that when you jump, you're smaller. But no, I was always tall. I won't say I was ever, you know, really strong, or strength wasn't going to be one of the assets, but I had a height advantage over most players, I suppose.
That's good. Connor, did I let you kind of jump in there?
Yeah, I suppose, Paul, for me, from a League of Ireland point of view, one of my first memories of the league, I don't want to put years on you here, I suppose, but it would have been kind of later on in 2001, 2002 with some of the controversy of that season. Now it's kind of something that gripped me with Pat kind of almost running away with the league and then having issues with players being registered or not registered towards the start of the season and losing out to Shields in the end.
Yeah,
I've never gone through something like that myself. What goes through players' minds in that dressing room when stuff like that is coming out after playing so well for so many games?
Yeah, I've often thought about that, and I don't think it affected us. I think if anything, it gave us a bit of a boost, in a strange kind of way. I can remember the situation. We were playing in UCD and we were in the Go Pub having a pre-match meal, and there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing going on with one or two of the players being called out, and some of the board members were there, and one of the players then all of a sudden said he was sick, and he wasn't available to play. And I mean, he hadn't been sick 2 minutes previous, so at the time you probably didn't really read too much into it. But with hindsight there, obviously he'd been pulled and told, look, you can't play today, there's a bit of a controversy going on over your registration. So it came out then, I think, during that week that there was potentially some administrative error had occurred, which is the best way I can put it. And subsequently then, I think we played a few games before. I think it was 15 points we deducted. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was 15. Yeah, it was
15 points. Yeah. So to be honest with you, as players, well, me personally, like it wouldn't matter whether we were 10 points clear, 10 points behind, deducted 15 points, awarded points. I think for most of that group of players, and I think successful teams are like that, that they just play and the surroundings are non-existent, really. You know, you're playing, you're in the zone, you go out and play, you prepare for the game, you go out onto the pitch, and really you're in a, you know, you're in a bit of a cocoon, really, until the game's over, and then you assess, okay, we won, we drew, we lost, where are we? We'll recharge and go again. So certainly, it never played on my mind, and I'm sure most of the players or all the players of that group would say the same, that we just got on with it. We just loved playing. We loved being successful. We loved winning games. And the circumstances before or after game were out of our control, so we could only control what was on the pitch.
And as you said, it kind of probably gave you that little bit of a drive then at the end of the season, debriefing for the next year coming up.
Yeah, and there was less pressure too, if I'm being completely honest, because when we were deducted 15 points, I don't think we could win the league really, barring a catastrophic fall away by Shelbourne. So we picked up a lot of points in that run in. I think we won our last five or six or something like that. But I know we accumulated a lot of points that maybe if it was tighter, we may not have. I don't know. But certainly it was one of the most enjoyable seasons I had, even though we won the league but didn't win the league.
Paddy, you want to jump in there?
Yeah. Talking about your schoolboy days earlier on, you were saying that you could have played anywhere. You just enjoyed playing football. So depending on your humour or the way you were feeling, you'd go into defence or midfield. When and how, I suppose, did you find your position and then decide, well, this is it. This is me for life now.
Yeah, that's a good question. I only spoke to somebody about this recently, and that was a long process because I started off playing as a left back with St. Pat's. My first couple of seasons I played there, and I can always remember Lord rest his soul, another great fellow who was fantastic for me. It was Noel O'Reilly, mm-hmm. And I remember Noel saying to me at one time, "You'd probably be better off playing higher up the pitch." Because he said you're an average defender, but he says you've got more ability. He said you're quite tall and that, but you're quite good on the ball and you can pass the ball well. Mm-hmm. So I ended up then playing again back in them days. It was a 4-4-2 system, so I played left side of a midfield and four, and played there. And I never had much pace. I wasn't the quickest. So if you were looking for me to go by fullbacks and things, that was never going to happen. But Brian Kerr, would have one of his great skills among many skills he had as a coach was that he could identify what players were good at and get you to focus on that. So he'd say to me, look, don't try and go by fellas. You're not going to go by them with pace and get crosses in. But he said, you're a really good passer of the ball. You can see passes. You're very accurate with your passing. So he said, do that more. Get balls into the strikers and things like that. Balls in behind and support from behind rather than be trying to depend on your pace. So I played there for a few years, and then I suppose I kind of got an enjoyment out passing the ball and getting on the ball. And you didn't get on the ball as much in a wide area. So yeah. I think toward the mid-90s, probably when I came back to Pats, I would have asked, look, can I play in the central midfield? So I went in and played in central midfield, kind of as I suppose you'd call it number six now, but in them days it was just a 4-4-2 or a 3-5-2 as we played in the Bucky later on. But I just found that area of the pitch just suited me perfectly because, as I said, I wasn't the quickest, I wasn't the fittest, I wasn't the most mobile. But I suppose if I had a strength that was reading the game well and passing the ball simple, that would suit me.
Isn't that what you see with the best footballers now, that they've a good football brain, like positionally, like they can see what's around them, and they're the ones that, like, I suppose, know what to do with the ball all the time. And as you said, what you lacked for, I suppose, in speed or whatever, you could definitely make up for in the knowledge of the game. And I suppose that's probably where you're a manager now.
Yeah, well, I think, with players, and there was another famous quote I remember, what's his name? German centre back. One of the, I can't remember, you might know members' names.
Beckenbauer.
Franz Beckenbauer. When he was playing for Germany and they were playing, I think it was Brazil or one of these South American teams, and he was playing centre-back and he was interviewed or somebody spoke to him and said, like, you're going to struggle in the game on Saturday because in a straight race between you and whoever it was from A to B, like, he'd leave you for dead. And Beckenbauer famously said, but the difference is on Saturday, I'll be halfway to B before he even leaves A. Which I think summed up that in the game, being aware of what's around you can be a massive help. That's in the pace stakes, like with Beckenbauer and that. But certainly as players, I think now, and even managing players now, that game awareness and I suppose it's game intelligence is a massive part. But it's doing it consistently, it's repeating things consistently because all players have the ability to do things one-off. And you could go to a championship game in England and look at a striker, say, for Preston or something like that, and he might be absolutely outstanding on the day, and you might say, why is he not playing the Premiership? But he probably only does that once in every five games, where almost players in any league in the world, and they're consistent.
Consistent.
And how do you train that mental toughness in players? because you can, as you said, you can train your football skills, but that's just something you have or haven't got, is it?
I think if you've got a good coach, it can help you, you know, and players will understand and learn in different ways. And you've got to be able to, I think, as a coach, know what makes a player tick. What does he understand? Does he understand what I say to him? Does he understand what I walk through with him on the pitch? Does he understand what I show him video clips? Does he understand on a tactic board? Does he understand animation? So even with that, even if you give a player what he understands and the best, he may still not be capable. Like it's like anything, you know, we all want to be things in life, but if you don't have the tools to do it, you can't. But you'll get to your optimum, your maximum. And whatever that is, then that's your level.
Yeah, yeah. That's brilliant, Paul. Thanks for that. Collie, back to you.
So I was just looking at kind of coming towards, I suppose we'll call it the break point of your Pats career. Was it straight after that season that you kind of had left for a little stint at Shamrock Rovers? Was it the year after that, or did you have another year before the kind of again?
Sorry, Collie, after which?
After kind of the point deduction year.
Oh, no, that was before that.
Right. Okay. So, just want to move on to your Rovers career, because you did have a brief kind of spell. I think Pats may have had a bit of financial difficulty at the time, and you moved over to Rovers for I think probably two seasons, wasn't it? Didn't really work out well. You got there for the first season and you won the league, and you got injured for the last eight games. Though, so maybe it did work out. But for you, in terms of kind of you suffered again, like we were kind of talking about before we came on air here, was your son Evan was obviously playing for UCD, doing his cruciate. Did you do the same injury?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
So it runs in the family.
It runs in the family. Yeah. The dog won it as well there last week.
So just talk to us about kind of that little stint, because I know, look, I you can read it up online and you can see that kind of you didn't feel like you were treated great at the time. Obviously, I don't know whether it was that down to kind of being injured and them not kind of looking after you as a person, rather than kind of anything else, or what was that there?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I'll go through as quick as I can. So,
yeah,
we won the league of Pats in 89-90 in my first season with the first team. And then a lot of players left at the end of that season. A lot went to Shamrock Rovers, actually, and Bohemians. So, Noel King was managing Shamrock Rovers at the time, and he contacted me on a couple of occasions out of season to see if I'd be interested in going to Rovers. And I said, no, like, Pats have given me the opportunity and I'm going to be loyal to them. And I'll be completely honest with you, like, he was offering me probably four times the wage I was on at Pats.
Jeez. But, yeah. It's hard to turn that down, though.
Back then, I didn't. And maybe because I was loyal, and maybe as well because I was in a bit of a comfort zone at Pats as well. You know, maybe I didn't want the challenge at the time.
Yeah, it can happen, yeah.
But I know the next two seasons at Pats, a lot of players left and they went through a lot of financial difficulty, and I mean, we always got paid. It was never an issue with that, but the club kind of went into a little bit of decline that 91-92, the 1990-91 and 91-92 season, and the 92-93 season. So Ray had taken over at Rovers, and he contacted me and asked me would I be interested. So I felt the time was right for me to move for my career at that time. So I went and met Ray, and he more, you know, we spoke about contract, and I didn't get a good salary. That's fact. It's not my opinion. I didn't get a good salary.
Bottom line.
I didn't get much of an increase to what I was on at Pats. And more or less, look, be honest about it, I probably wouldn't have had a great reputation then for being one who wanted to really put the hours in and probably missed bits of training and things like that. So I could see fully where they were coming from. But what was said at the time was, look, we'd sign a one-year contract. If you prove to us that you know, you've got the right attitude, you've got the desire, the hunger to play, we looked at substantially in the following year. So I went and played, and I think it was the 18th game. We had a fantastic season. Some really great players have played with there at Rovers. And we were miles clear in the league. And unfortunately, I tore my cruciate ligament in the RDS. Just it was innocuous, wasn't even a challenge. To this day, I think they used to have the show jump in there, and there used to be a water jump in, but they'd obviously fill that in then when the thing wasn't on. And it was only after I'd done the injury and I was in the stand watching the game, and it was quite heavy rain, and I could see a portion of the pitch, just a small little rectangular area, Well, it was a different colour. You know, you could see it was a different colour. And I was looking and I was saying, geez, I think that's where I stumbled. Like, I was just running to get the ball going out for a throw in. And I just stumbled. Now, look, it's gone now. And
then three-second fault, was it?
Sorry?
Well, I missed that. A three-second fault.
The penalty there.
Well, I don't know what happened, but I just stumbled as I was running and the knee just buckled in on the knee. So anyway, I missed the rest of that season with Rovers. And I had the cruciate done, and it was a big deal for me at the time. And it was a massive injury, and the surgery around it was a lot more than it is now. They've obviously, you know, techniques have developed over the last years, and it's probably be done keyhole now, and the recovery time is not probably as bad. Plus, the discipline players have now probably wasn't the same. Well, it certainly wasn't, because I know my own son done it, and I've seen how quick he got back and how disciplined he was. Mm.
Yeah,
I mean, I can remember, you know, being in somewhere where I probably shouldn't have been late at night and having a little stumble on the crutches and things like that. Like
on the dance floor.
I've never made it that far. Well, I missed the rest of that season, and Rovers went on to win the league. So I was expecting, you know, them to come to me and say, look, you've done well. Unfortunately,
you made an impact.
We want to re-sign you. You know, we're going to give you a new contract. We're going to up your money by whatever. But the only obligation they had was to offer me the same terms. That's the only obligation they had if they wanted to keep me as a player. So they didn't have the increase in pay. So they offered me the same terms. I wasn't too happy, you know. I wasn't going to play anyway at the start of the season, but I wasn't overly happy about it. So I had an approach from Derry City, from the manager there, and he said to me, listen, I think if you're a really good player, he said, I'd love to sign you. He said, look, I'm injured, Tony. I said, I'm months away from being fit. And I said, anyway, like, Rovers have retained me. So he said, well, do you want to come up to... Now, I shouldn't have done this because I was still a Rovers player, so I'm not a person to blame. I went to Derry. I moved up to Derry, and I done my rehab up there with Tony. He worked in a big factory up there that had a gym in it, so he used to, you know, oversee my rehab. And I got back playing. I was training with Derry City, and I was playing, you know, friendly games and things, and the knee felt okay. But the problem was, and again, part of this is my fault, and I was guilty of this, I was still a Shamrock Rovers player, even though the season was in now about 7-8 games at this stage. Even though I hadn't gone training with Rovers, and there was no contact between me and them, I couldn't play for Derry City because I was still a Shamrock Rovers player. So Derry City were paying me a few quid and looking after my accommodation up in Derry. So it came to the point where the board were getting onto Tony and saying, like, what's the story with this fella? Like, he's not even a player. I'm paying him and we're looking after his accommodation. So something needs to give here. So Tony came to me and explained this to me. And I said to him, well, what do we do? He said, well, I'm going to ask Shamrock Rovers, will they allow you to come on loan to Derry City? And if you come on loan, and the board have said, once you play X amount of games for us, that they'll give you a contract, and once they see your knee is fit and strong and that. So I said, yes, that'd be great. That suited me. But unfortunately, Rovers didn't see it that way at the time, and they didn't. They said I could go. No, they said I couldn't go on loan, but they'd sell me to Derry. Now, I hadn't played in about 18 months. And they were looking for mad money, basically, in my opinion.
Who's going to take the chance on that? Like, it's hard
The logical thing to do was to let me go on loan, but for whatever reason, that didn't materialise. So I had to go back to Dublin. Right. And when I went back to Dublin then, I met with the club, and I met Ray, and, you know, he just more or less said to me, you're suspended from the club for breach of contract, blah, blah, blah. So I don't go into all the details of that, but basically end up in court because I couldn't play for anybody. I couldn't play for Rovers. I wasn't allowed to train with the first team.
Yeah.
And so I went to the FAI at the time and ended up getting a solicitor and going to court, and look, the court found in my favour that I was unduly treated, and I was just awarded salary that I lost. And by the time I paid the solicitor and the barrister,
he was gone.
That was the end of that season at Rovers, and I left a bittersweet taste in my mouth because I loved Rovers and still do, and, you know, passes my club, played there, but Rovers was my club from growing up in the area in Farnham. They played in Milltown, and like, all my heroes then would have been Rovers players and the buzz of Milltown, and I went to Milltown regularly. So,
yeah,
you know, I left a little bit of a bitter taste in my mouth and probably in Rovers' mouth at the time, but I've got good relations with the club now, and there's no issues whatsoever, you know.
Cool, yeah.
It's a business, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just kind of moving out of kind of your playing career, then we'll move on to kind of the managing side of things. So I this was actually funny because I just done a little bit of research, obviously, when I knew you were coming on, just to see what you were doing. So I know you came out of kind of playing with Pats, or they kind of said we'd put you into the under 21. So did you take up that offer? Did you go with the 21s for a while in Pats?
I did, yeah. I went with the 21s when I stopped playing as assistant coach. Jerry, I can't think of his second name now. Jerry, he was the manager, I was assistant. And then he went to Drogheda.
Yeah,
the first game at Drogheda, and Jerry Scully, good lad, Jerry. Played in the league as well, played at Shelbourne, played at Drogheda, could have played at Rovers as well. But great fella, learned a lot off him. And I then took over as the manager of the 21s team at that stage. And Maurice O'Driscoll, who was a former player as well, he came in as my assistant. And I was there for about, I think, a season or so with the 21s. And then I just decided to move on. I didn't feel like I was going to progress in the coaching capacity at the club. Now, look, be honest again, like, at the time, you feel you're being hard done by, and opportunities came at the club and I didn't get them. I wasn't approached about them. And you feel like, you know, you're divine right to things, but I had no coaching badges or anything at that time. And
yeah.
I was a former player and I thought I knew. Looking back now, I mean, I had no idea how to coach. Yeah. I probably had an idea how to treat players and, you know, how to manage, but at the time,
you're thinking you've done so much for the club, it would be nice to just get the offer, even just someone to come and say, look, there's an opportunity here.
They did give me an opportunity with 21s, but there was a first team opportunity came and I wasn't really considered for it. Well, I didn't feel I was, so
yeah,
I just felt, look, I'm going to move on here. So I left, and my old sparring partner, Eddie Gormley, was out in Bray.
Eddie Gormley, yeah.
So I can't.
The funny thing, actually, sorry, just jumping in on that one. Actually, the funny thing about that one was, I think that was that 2008 to 2010. I think you were there, wasn't it? Around them years. Yeah. So the funny thing was, actually, with Eddie Gormley, Eddie actually rang me to go up to play for Bray. I was with Kildare County at the time in 2008 or 2009. Yeah. It was the year before they had folded, and I think he actually contacted me dad. And he went to the City Cabs, he got the phone number, he called me up, said, look, we're training. I went over, I done training and everything, and he said to me, right, look, we're gonna sign you. So now they had taken a lot of players in, they weren't being paid at the time. I think it was like, you probably know yourself. I actually never even spotted you there. I don't know if you were there at the time, but I think it was like three trainings a week or something in the match, but they weren't paying. Now I think I was only 18 or 19 at the time, so I was just happy to kind of be considered. But I don't know, for whatever reason, I trained, and Eddie said to me, look, he goes, wait around, we'll get you signed up. And I said, yeah, no problem. And I stood there after that training session, and I was waiting probably about 10-15 minutes. He was calling other players in, getting them signed up, and for whatever reason, I just said, you know what, this isn't for me, and I walked. And that was the end of my kind of high level football career. So if I had seen you there, you never know, because my dad was there as well at the training, and he would have been shouting at you, like,
I probably wasn't there then, Colly.
Yeah.
That's
a shame.
That was the end of that. And
he was short anyway, Paul.
You were looking for a mascot.
So no, that's always my biggest regret in football. But then at the same time, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it work. So I was working a full-time job and then obviously getting no pay, trying to make it over from Tala at the time to Bray. I think it was like a half six training or something. It wouldn't have worked, I don't think. But yeah, so look, we're going to move on from that, if you don't mind. Or did you have anything else, actually? How was your time actually at Bray? Did you enjoy that with working with Eddie?
I did, I was Eddie, and believe it or not, Keith Long was there at the time as well. So myself, Eddie, Keith Long, and Eddie Wallace was there as well. So yeah, look, it was a kind of an eye-opener for me, because they're playing in the Premier Division. I'd come from kind of 21's background with Pats. And I started to kind of realise then, you know, there's a bit more to this than just telling fellas what to do and throwing a few shapes and thinking, you know, everything, you know. So I kind of, that would have been kind of a turning point for me, you know, in wanting to become a coach and wanting to learn and educate myself as a coach.
Yeah. So, look, obviously we're gonna just move into where you are now at the moment. So I think, look, for anyone that doesn't know, obviously, the under-16s is that there's a massive kind of push on Irish football becoming a more expansive game. But I want to know, just before we get into kind of the nitty-gritty on kind of your style of play and stuff like that, like, just explain to us, because like I never really understood what way it works. Like, are you contracted? Like, obviously you're contracted with the FAI, but do you have like an expiry date? Like, what way does that work? Is it very similar to a senior level? Is there like an expiry date on your contract? They have to renew it if you were doing well, or like, what way does that work? So I don't get it from that kind of side of it.
I think we all have an expiry date.
I'm well past mine anyway.
No, well, look, I'm employed. So I was employed by the association in 2011, in a full-time role as a development officer in Westmead. So that would have encompassed all aspects of football, grassroots football, women's football, social inclusion. So that was my job. So I worked in that role for, I think it was 6 years, 7 years. But after 5 years in there, the under 16 national team manager role became available. So he could apply for it. So I applied for it. I was lucky enough to get it. I'd worked on some other emerging talent program squads and things like that. So I had a dual role. So I was under 16 head coach and development officer for Westmead. And that was very challenging because, you know, I could be down in Mullingar on a Monday night, on a late night league with, you know, maybe underprivileged kids or, you know, kids that had been in trouble with the law and things like that.
Yeah.
And the next day I could be going to play an international match and vice versa. I could come back from an international trip and then have to go and do that. And then there's nothing wrong with it. I love that job and it's very, very rewarding. But it was quite difficult to mix both. So,
it's hard to separate the levels, I suppose.
Yeah. And your time as well. Like, it was a lot of time, you know, with the international team and scouting and training and going away on trips and coming back then, and it was difficult. Yeah. And then I got a job about 4 years ago as a coach educator with the association. So that was now working with coach education, working on the licenses, on the B license, A license, pro license. I'd done my pro license now at this stage. I'd gone through all the education with the FAI in the previous 10 years or so, and I was a pro license holder, so I could work as a tutor on the pro license, mentor on the B license, A license. So that kind of allowed me a little bit more time for the international stuff, which was great. There was less of a commitment to the coach education. Although there was a commitment, but that was decided with the head of coach education, Niall O'Regan, who was brilliant in relation to, you're going to be away for 2 weeks in June, so make sure that you give yourself time to prepare. And when you come back, take a bit of time off, and we won't put you in for any of the blocks of the coach education around that time. So that's where that was. So in relation to contract and stuff like that, I'm an employee of the FAI, and my role now is, it just changed recently, where it's just a full-time under 16 head coach. Cool. A small bit still in coach education in relation to doing presentations and stuff like that on licenses. But I also have a lot more commitments now in relation to the National League and being a president of National League games and, you know, interacting with National League coaches and doing workshops and things like that for National League coaches. So that's where I'm at. So I'm not contracted to the under 16 job. I work for the association.
You work for the association. Yeah, cool. And it's interesting kind of you say that about kind of you being a part of kind of the coaching development side of things. So, because I was actually looking at it only a couple of weeks ago, I was thinking, because I done my knee as well. I done my ACL on my knee and I done my MCL and I fractured a bone in the same thing. And it wasn't even a challenge. It was more of an impact thing. A man hit the inside or the outside of my leg and my knee came inwards and fucked my knee up. So that was kind of the end of me. So, I was thinking of getting into the coaching side of it. The team that I was with, just a local team, they were struggling at the time, took over as the manager just for the year, just to help out, saved us from relegation and stuff like that. So I kind of actually really enjoyed my time there, but I found myself at work. Although it's like a very, very low level and a very poor standard, I'm spending the whole day trying to get me players, put a formation out, put all the things together. So I think the coaching side of thing is kind of really interesting to me. So I don't know if you can explain a little bit, there's two entry points. I noticed that there's two different entry points depending on what ages, or is it three? depending on the age group you want to coach?
Well, it depends. If you want to work in grassroots with young players and you want to specialise in that area, you can enter in at that level. If you want to work with older players, there's another entry level. And there's different pathways then, which is all very well.
It's a very good graphic, actually, on the FAO website that kind of gives you the little blocks.
So it depends on what you want to do. Like, a lot of parents, you know, who just want to work with their kids' teams would have had to do stuff that they may not have used in previous years, but now you can specialize and say, well, this is what I want to work in. So pathway for me. So it's really good. That changed a couple
that's
of
good,
years.
It's good. Yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
Nilo Regan would have implemented that, and he saw that, well, there needs to be a change here. So the pathways have all changed.
Yeah, that's very good now. Connor, I'll let you kind of jump in there.
Yeah, no, Paul, you mentioned obviously the way it came through with the FEI, and we've seen other people, Jerry Davis, we've seen obviously Jim Crawford and stuff come through something similar and the kind of same entry points. Are you seeing from the workshops, from the mentoring, that there is still a good bank of coaches coming through that kind of similar pathways to yourself to obviously, hopefully in the years to come, you move your way up through then, and we see it in the Aviva a couple of years' time on the touchline. You're giving me and Collie and Paddy tickets. But is there
got to get that one?
Be assistant manager.
Just in case. Are you seeing a good bank of coaches coming through to do those workshops to fill in for those grassroots levels, for those higher level kind of roles, I suppose, in the FEI?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a stigma, I suppose, in a way, over years of people thinking that because you're Irish, you can't be a good coach, you know. Like there are not a lot of Irish coaches working in the game across Europe, but yet we produce a lot of good coaches. Our coach education pathway is championed in UEFA. Like they use ours as a flagship, you know, of the process of which we put our coaches through their education. So certainly, I think there are a lot of good coaches. The problem in the country is that there's not enough full-time jobs for coaches because of the makeup of our league and the demographic of the country and the amount of teams we have, professional teams. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the underage National League has been a massive boost to the whole development of football, and it's given the coaches an opportunity now to work with league players, because if you're an A-licensed coach or a pro-licensed coach, well, definitely an A or a B-licensed coach, you want to be working with the best players. You need to have elite players to work with, and ultimately that's your aim. And that wasn't available to a lot of coaches until the National League came in with the underage setup. So when you look at the number of underage teams there are now in the country, each one of those underage teams needs a qualified A license or B license coach, depending on what level they're at. So the industry is getting better, but it needs an influx of finance from somewhere in order for these academies to be able to go full time, because a lot of coaches are given their time for free. You know, they've paid a lot of money to be educated as well, and they have full time jobs. Majority of them, some of them are lucky that they'll be in a club that's financially stable to be able to provide them with income, and they can do it full time. So there's an abundance of really, really good coaches in the country, absolutely no doubt about that. But probably the problem is where they apply their trade is probably the issue.
Yeah, we are seeing, you mentioned there, we are seeing the benefit now kind of the National League formation the last couple of years to get more of those high level coaches playing with or managing and coaching elite players.
Yeah, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. And it's a big challenge then, you know, if you get a job with the National League team, whether it's on the 15, 17, 19, 14, whatever age it is, you've got a responsibility now, you know, you're in the spotlight. Yeah, people might say that results don't matter, but they do. You know, your clubs want to be successful to be able to attract players. Yes, there's a certain amount of development that goes on as well, but it goes hand in hand with trying to win trophies for the club. So that's a really good bedding ground for the young coaches to be able to get their feet wet and something like that, and understand then the pitfalls and the challenges and the experiences that they gain are fantastic.
It is definitely a good start. It's definitely a good start considering the way we want to change our culture as a kind of football playing nation. That you can see it right from the top down. So that whole coach kind of coaching level is you can see it's definitely improving. Like, sorry, Connor, jump in there again.
No, I was just going to say, if I was a National League under 14 or under 15 coach, I definitely want to see five or six of my players picked by Paul to go to Spain for a training camp or something. It's going to look great. It's not just for the club, but it's going to look great for me if I'm looking to progress forward as well. So absolutely.
Yeah. You're not alone there, Connor. This
phone calls every day, I'm sure.
You think, and that's normal, you know, everybody wants to push their players and get the best for their players. But unfortunately, there's only so many players that can play in a squad, so it's difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Paddy, I'll just jump to you there. You feel there.
Yeah, from a grassroots level, again, I coach my youngfella in the academies on a weekend basis. And I see how technical now they use a thing called cover coaching. And it's really, really good for the kids. I remember hearing in the UK about 10, 15 years ago, they brought a lot more of the continental style of football play over there. And you're seeing a lot of technically gifted footballers now coming onto the scene through the youth teams and stuff. And I'm saying, do you think in the Irish setup now, are you seeing a lot more technically gifted players at the age of, say, 16, as opposed to when you were, say, 16? Like, do they take it a lot more serious nowadays?
It's a controversial word to use, technically gifted term, you know. And I know what you mean, and probably most of people listening know what you mean as well. But I think the biggest thing that I've seen, the biggest shift in our players, has been around just the whole understanding of the game, decisions. We use it, communication, decision making, execution. So if you put all them together, that's probably technique. So the players need to be able to communicate. They need to have a better game understanding. And that can come from the coach. It can come from, you know, analysis of games, videos, training sessions. And then from that, then they need to make decisions and execute them. And I suppose that's where the technique comes in, and how a fella can pass the ball, how accurate is his pass, and the pace of his pass, the weight of his pass, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's a holistic thing. I don't think it's just one thing that you can say, well, we've got technically good players. They have to be good communicators on the pitch. And key for me is they've got to make really good decisions. And those decisions are based off knowledge, experience, information they get from coaches. So it's a broad spectrum of coaching. Is not just one thing or another. It's a whole lot of things put together. And it's not only just on the pitch as well. It's off the pitch. It's dealing with players, because I mentioned earlier on, a lot of players learn in different ways. You know, I used to fall victim to the kind of thought that when I started coaching, I'm gonna be like the best coach I had. That's the way I'm gonna behave. So my favorite coach, the way he done things, that's what I'm gonna do. Right. And a lot of people would say that, and you're probably agreeing there. But it's when you think about that, it's probably the worst thing you can do, because you're not your players. So what I liked, some of my players might not like. So I've got to see what makes my players tick. What do they like? What makes Paddy play well? What makes Paddy prepare well? It might be a clip around the ear or a roast in training.
Guinness.
Whereas Connor, he's gone into a shell, and it's no point in playing him on the weekend. So there's a lot of different things. It's a holistic approach to coaching, and it's not just on the pitch. It's massive, and every time, every time we go away, we were just in Spain last week. Like, loads of things you learn. Like, I have a pro license now, and I've coached in, I know, 50-odd international matches, but still, every time we play, every time we train, I learn something different, learn something new, and I think that's the way you've got to approach it.
And has it changed setting up your team, like from when you were training, from when you were coming up through grassroots, to now how you train your teams?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think the game will ever change, so the game is always the game, but there'll be trends in the game, there'll be styles in the game, there'll be formations in the game that will mean that you've got to be up to date, and you've got to know like what the pitfalls are of one system against another, and key players. Can you play the way that you'd like to play? You might like to play counter-attacking football, but you don't have any quick players to counter-attack, so you can't do that.
Okay, there's
so many things you need to take into consideration, and each game throws up a different challenge then, because we played Spain and Norway last week, and there were two different. They both played different ways. Both played a 4-3-3 system, a 1-4-3-3 system, but there were different kind of nuances within that of what players, certain players do. So it's challenging. It's not just train, get fit, play five-a-sides, go out onto the pitch. Players need education. Players need information. They need detail. They need roles, responsibilities on the pitch. That's my belief anyway. Because I think without that, they're lost, you know.
And do you find it difficult with your players changing all the time as well?
Sorry?
At that age, do you find it difficult with your players changing constantly as well?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, you can have a year, and the thing about underage international football, you can't sign players. You know, you can't say, well, you can.
I keep him.
But you can't say, I want to sign so-and-so from another club. It doesn't work like that. So what you have is what you have. You might get a player from outside the country who qualifies to play. But it is. I mean, some years you have really, really good centre-backs. You've got really, really good striker. You might struggle in a full-back position. So you're kind of tampering with that, and you might have to adjust the way you play because you don't want to get exposed down in the full-back area. So you might play a bit deeper or a bit lopsided or whatever it might be. And then the next year it comes along and it's the complete opposite. So you've worked on something for one season and you're going back. And even from game to game, it can change. But it's I won't say it's frustrating. It's challenging.
Yeah,
you've got different players every year. It's definitely challenging, and you've got to take stock of the players you have and do the best you can with them.
Brilliant. Thanks, Paul.
Just a quick one. We're 51 minutes in, so we'll try move it on just a little bit. But one thing I just wanted to ask you, the last final kind of question on the Irish setup, just looking at the team or the squad that you named going over to Spain, I was just looking through the players, and I see there's a couple of Pats players and stuff like that on it as well. But I noticed that there's only one player that doesn't play in Ireland. Is that a sign that we're scouting better in Ireland, or are they not making it over to England at such an early age? Because I remember like players going over at the age of 14 and stuff, and then you'd see them back over in Ireland at 17, 18. Is that kind of a show of development over in Ireland, or what do you think that is like?
Well, it's a couple of things, Colly. Because of Brexit now, they can't go till they're 16 anyway. Sorry, they're 18. They can't go till they're 18.
18 now, is it?
18. They can't go till they're 18. They couldn't go till they were 16 pre-Brexit. So most of the players that I would have would be from National League clubs. Prior to that would be DDSL clubs, Cork Schoolboy League clubs, Cobra School, whatever the demographic was at the time.
Yeah.
But with the birth of the National League underage team, all of the players would be from National League teams. Not all. You might have a player from Schoolboy Club, but
yeah, you've one guy, Aidan Cannon. I think he's playing with Celtic at the moment, and he's the only one. Does he live there? Does he?
He's Scottish. He's from
Scotland. So that's what I mean. So he's kind of more I suppose local to Scotland in terms of kind of, he probably has an Irish mom or granddad or something.
Yeah, his father was Irish, his grandfather was Irish, but he qualifies to play for us. Now look, there are other players in the UK that qualify to play for us as well.
Probably harder to scout.
Well, they are. We have scouts in the UK, and I go over to the UK if players are flagged up, The thing I find, you know, a little bit frustrating is I get emails, and I genuinely just got one there now. I haven't read it, but a parent of a player, I don't know where, could be in anywhere in the world really, to say that young little Johnny qualifies to play and he'd love to play for you. But what they don't understand is that there's probably, I don't know the figures, but there could be 60,000 boys playing in Ireland that qualify, but they're not good enough. That's the harsh reality. I'm not saying they're not good enough.
The parents will think they're Messi's, like little Ronaldo's, and that's their retirement fund, like, you know.
Yeah, I think it's just that from outside the country, when parents realise that the kid qualifies to play for Ireland, they assume that they're good enough.
And
some of them are, because we've got some players from that avenue. But generally, you know, I just find that it's a little bit frustrating, and then you can't dismiss one, because there could be a gem there. So
We have
a network in the UK, and Mark O'Toole works for us over there, and a number of other guys. So I'll always flag up to Mark and say, look, this boy's playing at Bromley Town on the 15th. So he'll do a bit of research in, and generally speaking, if they're not at Cat 1 club in the UK Academy, like one of the big clubs,
they're
probably not at international level. That's not to say that they won't get there or that they're not. There's all, you know, there may always be one. But generally speaking, if they're with the big clubs, then
you'll spot them easier. Yeah, that's fair enough. Lads, we'll move it along. So we just have one little section that we're going to just jump into here, Paul, if that's all right with you. I hope you're impressed with these graphics that are coming up now.
Yeah, well, I'm expecting big things here now.
No, this is
earlier on.
Yeah, it's the ones we asked you before we came on. Now, so like I was saying before we kind of came on, just a couple of questions that we get sent in just on the Instagram page and stuff like that from a couple of followers. So I've got three questions that we'll jump on. Look, we're nearly an hour into it, so we'll keep them kind of short, brief. So I'll jump into the first one. So the first question we have is in from Aaron Singleton and US Sports Apparel, who sell all kind of American sports gear. But they came in with pretty much the same question. So who has come up over the last year or two, or else in kind of your current squad now, that you would see like kind of has potential or had the most potential to play at a really top level? Is there any names that kind of would spring to mind for us to watch out for? It's probably unfair to say, isn't it?
I can tell you who's done well. No problem. But I'm looking to answer that question because it's nearly an impossible question to answer, because development of young players is not linear.
Yeah.
And the best player this year is not necessarily going to be the best player next year. I'll give you an example. Andrew Omo with Babadelli, that's playing the senior team, I didn't pick him out on the 15 or on the 16. He was in the group. He was in the extended squad, but I didn't feel he was good enough at that time. So. Yeah. I mean, look where he's gone and done now. And there's been other players who I did pick that people didn't think were good. So it's a very, very difficult question to answer. But for the lads who've asked the question, I'll just go on what we've seen recently. There's a boy at Shamrock Rovers plays with, then Naz Raji. He's outstanding. He was absolutely top class in our most recent games. Sean Mackey, fullback at Pats, outstanding. Remind you of a young Seamus Coleman. But how they'll develop, I can't say. Yeah. So. Who will definitely play?
It's all down to how hard they work, I suppose, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, some players reach their full potential at a very young age and they won't get any better. Some players might not start peak until they're 17 or 18. There's injuries, there's a attitude, as you mentioned there. So there's a lot of factors involved. But to say who could definitely play at the top level is virtually impossible. But players that are doing really well just on our most recent games and that. It's probably unfair just to name two because all the lads done fantastically well. But two standouts for me were Naj plays at Shamrock Rovers and Sean Mackey, who's the captain of the team. And why I say that is speaking to the other coaches from Spain and Norway after the games, like they were two players that they singled out as
stood out. Yeah. So that's an unbiased opinion from someone who's only that's fair. Yeah. I'm gonna sound like kind of a proud parent, but I don't know if the name has probably come across. Paddy, Josh Delves, who I don't know, he plays for Shamrock Rovers at the moment. Now, what age would Josh be? 14?
He's only 12 now. Yeah, but he was over with City for a while.
But so he actually went over and signed for Manchester City. Now there was a few kind of, he didn't come back for kind of footballing reasons. It was more kind of a personal reason with the family. So he's come back over, and he actually came back over. And Man City sent him over a signed football with all the players that had signed. And it said, you're always welcome back. So, I mean, there's great potential in him. He actually looks like a brilliant player. Like, looking at him at the age of... Josh Dales is his name.
And he's Paddy's...
He's one of the guys we know. Paddy wishes.
My son of the guys. He's great.
He's one of our good friends. One of our good friends' son. So it's a name to kind of watch out for. I'll be clipping this now in 10 years' time. If he's a superstar, I'll be clipping this and I'll look like a legend. So
what's his name again?
Josh.
And what age is he?
He's 12 at the moment. So he's playing with Shamrock Rovers. But he's been.
You don't have to pretend to write it down, Paul. It's fine. You're gonna have to pretend. There's no paper there.
Yeah. Sick it out for you.
If you want to go a bit younger, I have a young foot at six. His parents.
Hold on. There now. If you want one,
it's probably someone just being conceived. Now, do you want to tell me about this?
Yeah, that's me. Yeah, I haven't even thought.
I'm gonna have a couple of glasses of wine after this.
Right, we'll move on to the next question. Connor, do you want to read this one?
Yeah, it comes in from Andy McNulty. So you've been working with kids for a while now. Do you have any aspirations of managing at a senior level, such as League of Ireland or higher or beyond?
I feel that the level I'm managing at now, adults, kids, youths, children, they're called men's under 16, so I don't know what the term is for them, but it's at the highest level of where I'm at. in relation to we play against whoever, Malta, Spain, Northern Ireland. It's the pinnacle of that age. So I think it's something I really, really enjoy. League of Ireland, probably, I must say I wouldn't have aspirations. I probably wouldn't, because I just think the whole industry is so volatile. Or higher for me would be, you know, U19, U21 at international level, because to me, international level is the pinnacle. Yeah. Of football, club football is different. Would I like to challenge a club football? It's often crossed my mind, but if I was going to manage in club football, I wanted to manage in club football, I don't think I'd like to do it in this country. I think I'd like to go to the continent somewhere, maybe at, you know, a second division, third division in a country there. I wouldn't get a job in, most likely wouldn't get a job in the top league because of the CV. Although, the Thomas, the fellow who manages Brentford, Danish.
Oh, Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank.
He managed Denmark's under 17 national team for a number of years up until quite recently. And Steve Cooper, who managed, almost got Swansea promoted last year.
Yeah.
He managed England's under 17. So, I mean, there is. It shows the pedigree that you have to manage international football. Yeah. So it's not like you're going from one sport to another. It's the same sport. Obviously, it's a different environment at a club, but it's something that often crosses my mind. I think managing the under 16s has a shelf life.
Yeah.
In relation to how far you can push yourself, and I would like to move on from that. But then you've got to wait for opportunities to come in international football. There's always maybe opportunities in other countries in international football. So I'm happy where I'm at now, but I certainly would like to have aspirations to do something else.
Cool. Yeah, that's good. Paddy, do you want to jump onto this one?
Yeah, this is another regular listener. So Rory Coleman, what's your thoughts on the referee strike across the country, and is there anything you think they could do to prevent this type of thing happening in the future?
I think it's a sad day when referees have to take the action that they've taken, certainly is. I don't blame them. I've been to a lot of games, you know, over the years, particularly over the last couple of years, I've noticed creeping in where the abuse they take is shocking.
Shocking,
Generally from parents, in my experience from parents, obviously some coaches get a bit animated as well, and obviously players will, but I don't know. I think it's a really, really bad day when they've got to go on strike. Well, I can certainly see why they did. Is there anything you can do to prevent this type of thing happening in the future? I really believe that parents should be kept away from. I'm a parent. I watch my kid play growing up, and we all want to go and watch our kids play. I'm not saying you should ban parents, but maybe they should be a distance away from the sideline. No, they've tried things like that with Peter's being roped off and stuff, but they're still quite close, and you can still hear the verbal abuse. So I don't know if I was to give a knee-jerk reaction to what you could do, you know, initially, that wouldn't cost a lot of money. Just rope the pitch off, or you know, keep the parents a good distance away from the sideline.
Yeah. Right. Look, that's all we have on that one. Paul, do you have another 5-10 minutes just to talk about the heart attack incident that you had a couple of years back?
Oh yeah.
Just I don't want to end the podcast on a bad note or anything, you know. But no, I think definitely with stuff that's kind of happening in recent recent months. Obviously at the Euros, it kind of had sort of kicked it off. Now look, it's happened before, but Christian Eriksen being one that had kind of just played on the pitch and just collapsed, and then we've seen it only twice in the space of a month nearly. The Newcastle fan who obviously suffered the cardiac arrest in the crowd, and then Norwich and Chelsea there, I think it was another kind of fan had it. Paddy is an ex-paramedic, so will be kind of well up on that type of thing, but he'll probably understand a lot of stuff that you're saying, because he's probably experienced people going through it. So can you talk to us a little bit about so tell us your experience about it as well.
Paddy, you might correct me here if I'm wrong. I think the cardiac arrest, like the Ericsson situation and Mwamba back many years ago, I think that's a sudden the electrics of the heart stop working correctly.
You're still looking to give it a smack, but sometimes it's just no point in even giving a shock. So
That's an atrial fibrillation, is it? Am I good at that?
Yeah. Ventricular. Ventricular.
Okay. Well, my situation was slightly different. And again, as the simplify, I think, is the doctor would have said to me, you've got your plumbing and your electricity in your heart. So the electricity in my heart was fine. It wasn't an electrical issue. It was more a plumbing issue, which I was unaware of. So basically, it's 10 years, coming up to 10 years now, 9 years anyway. I just started experiencing heartburn. What I thought was heartburn coming up my throat. Mm. One Sunday evening going into the Monday morning, and I never suffered with heartburn, and I ate well, and I looked after myself well. I don't think I ever had heartburn, but I remember the next day I bought a pack of Rennies. I thought, man, must be something I ate. So the Monday night, the same thing, going into Tuesday morning, the exact same thing happened. And it was nearly like an alarm clock, because I happened at nearly the exact same time, because I had a digital radio in the bedroom. You could see what time it was. And I think it was around about 5 o'clock in the morning. The Tuesday morning when it happened, it was more severe, and I kind of panicked a little bit, and it was really like a burning coming up my throat. So I kind of thought something wasn't right, but again, being male, you think, I'm grand, nothing's going to happen to me. So I remember that Tuesday night I was doing a little bit of coaching with St. Mochta's in the Leinster Senior League, and I went up to Blanche IT, took a training session, and I remember during the training session, I was just standing, I think I was giving directions for something in the session, and I got what now I know was kind of probably a mini heart attack, where I got like a jolt across my chest, you know. Mm. It just felt like my chest just wobbled. Nothing else happened. I kind of got a little bit of shock, continued on the session, drove home that night, and I said to the wife when I came in, I said, I'm going to go to the hospital tomorrow. I said, "This something's not right. I don't know what it is. I just don't." And she said, "Dad, look, you'll be grand. See how you are tomorrow."
Went to bed. Yeah,
absolutely. I went to bed on the Tuesday night, and I woke up again on the Wednesday morning, nearly alarm clock, 5:10, whatever time it was. But this time, it was like somebody was choking me with this burning coming up my throat, and I felt like I was choking. And I can remember, I'm sure you've all experienced, you get up for work one morning after being on the beer for the previous 3 days, and you feel like shit, and you sit on the side of the bed, and you put your head into your hands, thinking, "Oh, Jesus, I've got to get out of bed." I can remember doing something like that, feeling, "Fucking hell, I feel terrible here." And
yeah,
I remember doing that, and then just rolling back onto the bed. And the next about 90 seconds, I was passed out. And my wife rang the ambulance, paramedics, and she said, "Well, okay, so I'll just go through that." I came through again. She pulled the pillow from underneath me, right. And I remember just kind of waking up, and I was sweating, and I was cold, and I was hot. And she was on the phone, and paramedic was talking to her, and the ambulance came eventually. Well, it was quite quick. It was within 10 minutes the ambulance came, and it was very funny. By the time the ambulance came, I had more or less fully got my faculties back together. I felt okay. Mm. I was in a little bit of shock because I knew something had happened. And I put on a T-shirt and a pair of tracksuit bottoms, and I was sitting on the side of the bed, and the paramedic came up. It was a fella and a girl, and the fella walked into the bedroom, and he says, "Jesus, Ozo, are you all right?" He was a Pat supporter.
Funny, you know? Preferential treatment, huh?
I don't know. I said, "I'm hoping you're going to tell me." So I walked down into the back of the ambulance, and he put a six-pointer, Paddy, ECG on it. He just said to me, "Your heart is fine anyway." He said, "You know, there's nothing wrong with your heart." And that was the first kind of mention of heart. And I'm thinking, nothing wrong with my heart. I'm 45 and fit and healthy. Mm-hmm. So I did suffer high blood pressure, which was diagnosed probably about 6 months before that. But again, I didn't relate anything to
any family history or anything like that?
Family history a little bit. Yeah, my father had hardening of the arteries.
Okay.
There's a term for it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
So the ambulance man said to me, "I'm gonna have to bring you up to Tala," he said, "because you've passed out, like it's protocol." I said, "I don't really want to go feet." He said, "No, you have to come." So went in the ambulance to Tala and got into Tala Hospital, and I was put onto a trolley, brought into a cubicle. And I remember lying in the cubicle and thinking, "I'm gonna be here now for the whole day, lying here, and they're gonna tell me this evening at 7 o'clock, there's nothing wrong with you, go home, blah, blah." So these are the thoughts going through my mind. So a nurse came in, and she put a 12-point ECG on. And she said, I'll come back to you in a minute. She said, I just need to check on somebody else. So she came back, and I'm lying on the trolley in the cubicle. And when she came back, like, her jaw dropped. She just opened my mouth like that. So she could see the reading on the ECG.
Mm.
And I had what you might know, Paddy, is a STEMI. ST elevates myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, basically. And it was my LAD, which is I don't know if you're familiar with the LAD. It's the widowmaker, they call it. I didn't make a widow at that time, but that's what they call it. So
did you get your stent in?
I was rushed up to Resus, and the cardiologist came in about an hour and a half later. They were contemplating bringing me to James's because I've got a 24-hour cat lab. And the doctor said to me, look, what you need to get done is quite urgent. He said, we can bring it to James's and you'll get it done there. And I said, well, what would you recommend? He said, well, if it was me, he said, I'd stay here because if anything catastrophic happens to you going from Tallaght to James's, they might not have the best, you might be in the best place. He said, if you stay here and anything goes badly wrong, you're in a better place. So I waited there and the team came in then around 7:30 or so, and I had a stent put into the LAD.
The cat lab in Tallaght as well, haven't they? Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
cat lab in Tallaght, yeah, but it's not 24-hour.
And I suppose you were saying about the electrical and circuitry, the differences between them, but I suppose one leads to the other. So you were very lucky. So if the blockage had been any worse, that's when you form a bit of scar tissue around the heart, and that's when the electrical pathway can't get through.
Yeah.
That's when the arrest happens. So you were really, really lucky. Like, so it's great to be able to sit here.
I was, my wife said to me that when I passed out, I was kind of gagging, like choking. And subsequently, after all this, like, they couldn't believe I survived, and I have no scar tissue either. Like my what's the thing that the volume, the blood pumps, the heart pumps the blood out. There's an ejection fraction, which is a measure of how healthy your heart is. Mine is normal even after a heart attack. So
all your years of football.
Well, they did say that, but they did say that I was very fit and I had a good, healthy heart. But it was genetic anyway. I mean, it was nothing to do with diet or anything like that. I just had, my body just produced bucket loads of bad cholesterol. This was getting stuck in the artery. So it was nothing to do with diet and nutrition. So that was basically it. And I just go back now once a year probably now, and I've had a couple more. I actually had a restenosis of the stent. So I got some mild symptoms and went back in, and they're brilliant, I have to say, fantastic. Yeah. Got me in straight away, done an EC, done an angio, and seeing that the stent had started to, my own body was closing the stent in, but they regrowth the skin, so they had to put another one in and just open up the one that was there. So
in and out of the day, right?
Sorry,
in and out in the day.
I was gone. By,
well, look, that was a great way to. Cheers to that. Fair play.
Just a quick one. Like, how important do you think it is that for, like, say local teams that may not have that quick kind of reaction if it happens on a pitch to have defibs and the training?
Well, it's a no-brainer, you know. It's a no-brainer. Yeah. You have to have a defib. I mean, whatever happens in relation to what kind of heart-to-heart event you have.
Yeah.
Like, the defib is last resort, Paddy, really, isn't it? If you're gone.
Absolutely. And Paul, I said it messing earlier on about the assistant manager, but I can use the defib and all. So if you're looking for anybody on the sideline, might you give us a shout?
It's a no-brainer to have one. Every club should have one. Absolutely.
Like, early intervention is the most important thing with any sort of arrest. Early CPR, early defibrillation saves people's lives. Every minute you don't get defibrillated or you don't get CPR, like, is just your percentages drop so quickly. Yeah. Like, if you get somebody in the first 2-3 minutes, they have a very high percentage of living. And after that, you'd be lucky. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right. Well, look, Paul, I know it was a bit of a down note to kind of end the podcast on, but it's definitely something that needed to be talked about. Like,
it's not. I have absolutely no problem talking about it. You know, seriously, I actually enjoy talking about it in a way. You know, I'm here to tell the tale. No problem. But what I would like to say to anyone listening, like, you know, mid-40s, early-40s, late-40s, I would say, and I'm sure Paddy will agree with me, know your bloods, get your bloods done, know what your cholesterol levels are, know what your blood pressure is, because they're red flags for potentially having an event, you know, and if you've got to take a tablet every day to lower your cholesterol or lower your blood pressure, it's far better off doing that than probably not waking up one morning.
It's a big issue with men for men, isn't it? You know, like, you know, as you said earlier on, you know, I'm a bloke, I don't need to go to the hospital, it'll be brand new.
The fear of knowing that there's something wrong with you, isn't it? I think that that's what it is. It's the fear of going, like, you think your whole life's going to change, like, you know, you go, I have to go and get surgery, and you think of worst case scenario, like, but I mean, it's better to know than to not know, because it could be over like that, like, so so look, brilliant to talk to you,
you're in that age bracket, you better get yourself checked.
No, that's what I thought. You said, Paddy, you'll know what I'm talking about. I didn't realize you said at the paramedical. Jesus, it's not obvious.
Right, but look,
cap next week.
Lads, I think we'll end it at that. We were going to do a couple of questions, but I think we've run a little bit over, so we'll end it at that. Paul, we might get you on at some stage later on in the year or something like that. Yeah. Fancy coming on, yeah.
Look,
massive thanks from yourself and the lads for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Paul.
Look, like I said, anyone that kind of has any questions at all about that type of thing, you've nearly got your answer. Go get yourself checked if you have any issues with the heart or anything like that. But in terms of kind of your career and all, fair play to Paul. You've done fucking super things, and hopefully it continues with the under 16s, and hopefully you go above and beyond where you want to go. So best of luck with everything in the future.
Okay, listen, super lads. Lovely speaking to you.
No worries. You can hang on there. You can hang on there, Paul. I'm going to end this here, and we'll end it in 2 seconds. So, look, I do want to thank everyone for coming on individually. So, Paddy, nice for coming on this week.
Cheers. I'll send you my CV later, Paul. Yeah.
Connor, cheers.
Yeah, cheers, lads.
And again, Paul, cheers. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks very much, lads.
Right. Cheers. We will be back next week at the same time, same place. So make sure you hit the subscribe button and stuff like that on YouTube to help us grow. So thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next week.